This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone. Well, we haven't had a show yet, I don't think, that hasn't referenced COVID-19 in some way, shape, or form. And today's show is no different, but we're going to take a different take on things. COVID-19, of course, has forced many people to find different ways to work, stay in contact with family, colleagues, and friends, and keep those creative juices flowing. It's been particularly challenging for those involved in the entertainment and performance fields. Local musician and author Alan Doyle is not letting the mosque grow under him despite the pandemic. He's out with a new book altogether now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. He joins me now live on Target. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. So I have a little pre publication copy of this.
Yep.
I tweeted out a picture of it. I mean, everybody's going to say, oh, that doesn't look very good. But the media, we get these little plastic foil versions of books before they're actually published. So how are things going?
Oh, it's challenging times, but I'm having a good time, you know, and been lucky enough to have some cool projects to work on to keep me busy while we got to be off stage for this extended time. So I'm grateful for that. You know, I went to work at the book, as you mentioned. I spent most of the month of May writing that, and then went to work on a record that I produced with friends of mine and the Anna Sisters and Rachel Cousins and Fortunate Ones and The Once, and then been working on this musical project with some friends for the Charlottetown Festival, and lots of fun stuff to do, and not to mention I spent the summer bombing around Newfoundland with my family. It's the first time I had the summer off since I was 12, so that was great fun, I must say. I'm trying to make the most of it. It's no doubt it's a challenging time for the music industry and everybody in it, myself included, you know, not, you know, financially as well as other things, but we try to make the most of what we have. And
was that the silver lining, the time spent with family?
Yeah, one of them, you know, and the, because it's not something I'd normally do, you know, take a whole summer off. I never did in my life, you know, like, and this summer I did, and it was awesome. I really liked it. and our little fellow's 14, so, you know, he's getting the age where, you know, summer spent with his folks are probably getting thin, you know what I mean? So it was great, and I really enjoyed it, and you know, there's a couple other silver linings, like the projects that I sort of got to do that I wouldn't have done really this year because I would have been touring, because we had a big year planned. And so, you know, it's really just about making the most of what you have and try not to worry too much about what you don't have.
So this is admittedly a lighter side of Alan Doyle, I guess. You're a light guy anyway, most times, or at least
sure.
Your public persona is. Is that what prompted the book, you know, some of this heaviness that we've been dealing with in the last little while?
Definitely. And in all honesty, the idea for it came from the publisher, because I was writing this other book, this longer book that involved some travel back to England and Ireland and a few things that, of course, all got put on hold when the pandemic hit. So they asked if there was anything at the end of April. They asked if there was anything that I could put together in the month of May, we'll say, that they could put out in the fall. And we talked about it for a while. And I said, well, do you think a short story book, you know, that, you know, if I could stitch together stories I would tell if we were at the pub all night, you know, having a yarn with a bunch of people, do you think that people would like that? And they said, well, I think people would love it. And I was like, well, let me try to see if I can do it. So I started at it in May, and the result is altogether now a collection of, like you say, the subtitles, Light Tales for Heavy Times. And it's really a recounting of, you know, some of the more amusing parts of my young life and my adult life as a fellow from a small town, you know, being placed in these really, really worldly and incredible circumstances and times. And what I like to tell people right away is that what you're about to read is not a recounting of my greatest victories at all.
Well,
in more cases than not, it's about my greatest folly, you know, that I'm confessing to for my embarrassment and your enjoyment.
You have a particularly funny story there about the late, great Jeff Healey. Do you care to share it with us?
Oh, yeah, myself, it was just, I won't give away the whole story, but myself and Daryl Power and Sean McCann and Bob got a gig with Craig McSea, of course, playing in Central Park. And I think it was 2000, but it might be 1999, I can't remember. And it was like a Canada Day thing, July 1st, in Central Park, and it was Craig McSea, Jeff Healey, and Tragically Hip. So we got to meet, you know, our heroes of the day, you know. It was like, you know, there were huge international bands, Tragically Hip, Gord Downie and Mitch Healy and all that stuff. And it was all going really well. We were knocking it out of the park, as they say. And then myself and one of the other guys had to, we had an encounter backstage with Jeff Healey that led to an embarrassing moment. And you should pick up the book and check out what it was.
Yeah, I won't give away too much, but it's pretty amusing for sure. And I'm sure one of those moments that you had to say to yourself, now, how did I end up here?
Oh, yeah. Well, and you know what? And I didn't think about that myself until someone mentioned it the other day. It was like, it's really the if there's a through line through the book, it's that. It's just like, how did I end up in this chair that I'm in right now? And it's true for, you know, some of the things, you know, that, you know, as a person in the music business or in the movie business or whatever. But it's also true of like a parent being a dad, you know, and this is like these most odd circumstances in my, what I call my lucky life, you know, because even the mistakes I've made are funny.
Did you rely on your own recollections, or are you a little bit like Keith Richards and had to rely on others in helping you with those recollections?
Well, with this book, with a couple of exceptions, I wrote them as if I was telling them in the pub. And if you're telling them in the pub, you don't have time to go remember if it was, you know,
October 16th, 1982.
Yeah, and because it doesn't matter in the pub, you know what I mean, and so that's the way I write them in the book. Now there was wherever possible, you know, whether there's obvious dates, like for example, there's a date of the Grey Cup, you know, the championship that's referenced, so it's easy to find that out, you know, you just look up when the date was, and it all makes sense and all that. But there was a couple of times where I really wanted to make sure I had it right if it involved some people that we know, like the Jeff Healey one. I talked to Daryl about it. I said, Daryl, is this how you remember it too? And so it was all cool. Yeah. Mostly though, it's sort of off the cuff.
Did you keep journals in your younger years?
I did. Not in my younger years, actually, but it's when Great Big Sea started. I have two or three handwritten journals that I started writing. I think the first, if I remember correctly, the first entry, because the band started in 1993, and I started writing a journal in March 16th, I believe it is, 1994, when it was the morning of like St. Patrick's Day weekend, and we were about to go on breakfast television. I remember that. That's the first entry, and I, for two or three years, I kept it until the internet came around, and then I started writing what's called a From the Road blog, and I wrote a road journal that's published was on the Great Big Sea website. You can still find it around. There must be 700 or 800 entries in it. Yeah.
Are you glad you did?
Yeah, I mean, most of that stuff from the early journal stuff was just because, you know, I had this feeling that I still can't quite shake that this is all going to come to an end. You know, that this incredible opportunity that I've been given is temporary, and that someone's going to walk in the door any minute and go, "Hey, you didn't actually practice guitar," and I'm going to go, "No, I know I didn't. God no." And so I talk about it like it's a rowboat ride, you know, and it's like, you know, say if your career or whatever is like a rowboat ride, then you have to row hard. Or the keep your head down and row hard, or the boat ride will be over, right? You also, you know, you don't want to spend your whole rowboat ride never looking up once to enjoy the rowboat, you know? And like, so there's, you know, there's two errors you can make. You can row so hard that you never enjoy any of it, or you can row a little bit and then spend all your time looking around and can't, you know, not believe in your luck, and then the rowboat ride is over as well. So you know, there's a balance in there, and that's the great challenge for anybody who has a, you know, gets to do what they love for a living, I think.
Well, indeed, because it had to be a whirlwind for all of you. You were all so young at the time, it's hard to imagine now. I remember seeing you on stage in Gander way back when, before you became huge, and knowing and sensing, there was a very small crowd there, but I think among the small group of people that were there, really getting a sense that these guys are great, we hope they do something, and then all of a sudden, boom, it happened.
Yeah. Were we at the, like, Reflections or something like that, where we were at Friars Club?
I think it was at the stadium.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
But that's going back a few years now. You and I are the relatively same vintage, so I don't want to give too much away.
I'm way older than you.
I'll admit to that.
Anyway, the cool thing about the trajectory, if you will, of the band, you know, is that it was always steady momentum. You know, and it was always steady forward movement, you know, and it was like, it wasn't like we woke up one morning, we had the biggest hit in the world, you know, and then like we were being flown to Spain, you know, to headline the festival or anything. But every year we did a little better, and every year it was a little bit bigger and a little, you know, and it was just, it became, you know, it was great, you know, it was a great ride, and I loved every second of it.
My guest today on Target is Alan Doyle. He's got a new book out, All Together Now, and Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is none other than Alan Doyle. He's got a new book out. We've been talking a little bit about it, All Together Now, and Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. And referencing back to that Jeff Healey story, Alan, you must have rubbed a lot of elbows over the years, so to speak.
Oh, yes, all part of a lucky life where, you know, when you find yourself either, like, in the music business with some of the biggest music makers in the world just by luck, you know, or design. And then certainly because I ended up taking a detour in the movie-making business, you end up in even more wonderful, cool circles, you know. And then it's all been a great blessing, and I'm only happy to tell about it in the book.
Did you always find yourself along the way sort of pinching yourself, saying, is this real? Am I really living this life or what?
Yeah, you do. And it's not just about, like, the celebrity part of it. It's kind of like, you know, it's, you know, even since, you know, stuff with, you know, my family or my son or what have you, you know, it's just like constantly shaking my head going, like, how did I manage this? This is fantastic. I'm lucky, you know, and I was lucky as a kid, you know, because I was born into the musical family of the Doyles in Petty Harbor. So it just happened, you know, for a fellow who ended up wanting to be a musician, it was just everywhere, right? Music was just around me all the time. And so I just, you know, I've had some great, you know, great blessings. And even with, you know, all the Great Big Sea stuff, you know, I mean, Sean and Daryl and Bob had an amazing band before Great Big Sea started, and called Rankin Street. And they asked me to join a new band, you know, so, like, it was just, that was lucky. It was all good.
I don't think I've heard a interview you've done yet where you haven't mentioned Petty Harbor. It really does play a big role in who you are.
Yeah, it does, and in ways I don't think I would have understood until I wrote my first book, which is called Where I Belong, which is really a description of my young life growing up there, and the good times and the family and all that stuff is certainly well in there, but and the music and all that stuff. But the thing I didn't realize until I wrote the book was how important the lessons I learned were as a kid, like cutting out tongues on the wharf in Petty Harbor, how important those lessons would become and how well they would serve me as a young adult and ongoing in my life, you know, as an older adult, you know, and like, it's just, it's incredible that you know, that part of my life has just served me so very well.
To borrow a phrase, rock and roll is a vicious game. Do you think that upbringing helped ground you to a certain extent, helped you keep your head about yourself?
Well, I think being from anywhere in Newfoundland and Labrador helps you do that. You know, and I think that's too, you know, it's for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a small population, you know, so, like, everyone here knows me and, you know, as you know, some fella in the band probably, but they probably knew something about me before that, you know, like my joke out in Petty Harbor and Southern Shore is that I'm still Bernie's brother, you know, who's not a good softball player as Bernie, you know, or like I'm Tommy's son or Ronnie's nephew who plays guitar in the band with Ronnie, you know, like, and you know, it's and I don't think, you know, this is not the kind of place where, you know, you'd roll into the top of the Duke steps in your golden Hummer with your fancy watch on or something, you know, like just that kind of stuff is just not rewarded here, and I'm only grateful for it.
A story that sticks out in my mind that you told was one, I believe it was your grandmother. She asked you, are you still playing in the band? And you said yes, and she said, not working then.
That's right. Yeah, it's not working. That was the Doyles, you know, second job, you know, like the Doyles and Petty Harbor were the band. And you know, almost none really of my family ever did it full time for a living until I did, I don't think. And then we, you know, but everybody in the Doyle family just about it was always musical, and they always organized concerts and all, and they still do, you know, still the band. And, you know, it's just been a real blessing to come from that lineage and just to be one little link in that long chain.
Robbie Robertson in The Last Waltz speaks very profoundly about the rigors of the road and the fact that, you know, that huge band called it quits at such an early stage. You know, they were all so young, and yet they'd been doing it. Robbie Robertson at that point had been doing it since he was a teenager. Is there something to be said for, you know, the road and the rigors of the road?
Oh, it's a challenging life, ain't no doubt about it. And it's not for everybody, and it's also not for everybody at every stage in their life. You know, just like anything else, same drill for. I mean, there's lots of things that people do. For example, in the agriculture world, that they would do when they're 25 that they wouldn't do when they're 45. You know what I mean? So it's not different than other industries in that regard. But it is. You know, some people find the traveling hard, you know, the act of just leaving home, and some people find the flying or the busing hard, and that's all part of it, you know, the same way, I guess, if you were in the Navy or something, you might get tired of getting on a boat, you know, but we do live in Newfoundland, you know, it's an island out in the middle of the ocean, and if you want to be in the performative arts from out here, it involves, you know, just about every job starts with an airplane, and so if you want to do it and live out here, you need to just accept that and find a way to make it a productive time. And to be honest with you, that's where I started writing books. It's on airplanes. It's just because, you know, since about 1996, I fly 100 times a year. And that's a lot of time to give up, you know, sitting in row 13C. And, so I just started passing the time on airplanes and dressing rooms and stuff, writing books. And the first two books, the Where I Belong book and the Newfoundlander in Canada book, I really wrote exclusively on the road. And that's what makes this current one really different in terms of the processes, because I did it all from home. Of course, I had to, because everyone was stuck home. So the All Together Now book was really exclusively written in this house that I'm sitting in right now.
And it was important for you to stay in Newfoundland. Why?
Oh, you know, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, other than I can tell you this. In almost 30 years of traveling to some of the greatest cities in the world, it has never once occurred to me to live anywhere else. Now, isn't that weird? It's a little weird when you think about it, but it's never once crossed my mind, you know, like. And it's like, well, why do you live in Newfoundland? It's like, well, why do we walk on our legs and not our hands? I don't know, like, because it's where I live, you know, it's where I'm from. And I never, like a lot of people, I never had to leave here, so I didn't. And the most, I would say, there's a significant portion of people who leave Newfoundland wish they didn't have to. And I never had to, and so I don't want to.
I think an awful lot of people would understand where you're coming from on that, especially among our listeners today. My guest today on Target St. John's is Alan Doyle. He's just out with a new book, All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is Alan Doyle. You know him as a musician. He's also an author, an actor. My gosh, is there anything you haven't done, Alan?
I haven't worked on a musical before, but I'm doing that now, too.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about that, or can you?
Oh, I can, for sure, yeah. The Charlottetown Festival secured the rights a couple of years ago to the story that you and I and most of our listeners here would know as the film called The Grand Seduction. I remember it starred Brendan Gleeson and Mark Critch and Gordon Pinsent, and about a small coastal town that needs to secure a doctor to get a factory to come in there. They need a full-time doctor. Anyway, the Charlottetown Festival secured the rights to that production to adapt it to a stage musical. And so Adam Brazier, who's the creative director there, and Bob Foster, who's the musical director for Come From Away, contacted me about writing songs for the musical, which I did, and then I became a part of the development team. And we've since added Ed Rich, who's a wonderful playwright and novelist here in Newfoundland.
Incredibly funny. Writing.
Always amazing. And my dearest old friend, Gillian Kiley, as the director. And many people will know Jill from Artistic Fraud here and from working at the National Arts Center as the director of English theater up there. And then, but of course, Jill goes way back with me and Greg Hocko and Alan Hocko and all the Hocko boys and a lot of the other people, the awesome people I was surrounded by when I graduated from St. Kevin's High School in the Gulls.
So you're working on a number of other projects, I understand. What's going on?
Oh, just doing. I mean, I've been working on that the book and working on this and the record that came out, and then I'm just doing primarily. I'm actually looking about what I'm going to do next now. And after I finish the promotion for this book, there's another workshop we're doing for this musical, and then there's a couple other projects that I may end up doing, but I'm not totally sure yet. And fingers crossed, I get a couple of them, because nothing scares me like a blank calendar, I'll tell you.
Do you miss it? Do you miss performing, keeping that calendar busy?
Yes, every day. Yeah, I do, and I miss the muscle memory of doing a gig and playing concerts. I miss it, and I miss giving people a great night out, and I miss the hang with creative, cool people, friends of mine in the band, and I miss them. I miss the bus rides, and I miss it. I do.
Is that what helps keep those creative juices flowing, interacting with people who are equally creative or more so?
Yeah, it's a privilege. It's such a privilege to get a chance to do that, to be in a room with super talented, passionate people, whether it's working with, Jill and Ed on the musical, or working with, the Ennis Sisters or the Once or Rachel Cousins or Fortunate Ones on a record. Or that's such a privilege, like only the lucky few get to sit in those chairs, and I've been real lucky, and I feel grateful every time I get to sit in a room like that and work on a song or a story or a book or a play or whatever, like it's such a wonderful experience almost every time.
The vaccine is distributed, travel bans are lifted, other restrictions ease. What's your first thing on your agenda?
I'm kind of hoping that the first thing will be told to me in a perfect world. The first thing, hopefully my agent or my manager will call, okay, the green light is on, you have to go here to go back to work. And that's what I will do. I'll go back to work wherever my agent or manager tells me to go. Because that's what I'm most eager to do. I've had great holiday time, as we talked about, and great home time, and I've had great fun in my studio and working on creative projects. But what I'm really eager to do is get back to my main job, which is, standing on stage trying to give people a good night out.
We've all been so focused on what comes next. Once this is behind us, we all talk in those terms. But is there anything during this particular time that has helped you grow or that you've learned?
I think I've learned that I don't need to be afraid of a blank date on the calendar. And I know that sounds odd, probably, to most people. But to me, and I think for a lot of people who live in the gig culture, we live and die by what's written on the calendar. Where are you next Saturday? And of course, the pandemic, we don't know. We don't know where we're going to be next Saturday, and we don't know when the next Saturday is, you know. And so I've spent most of my adult life knowing where I'm going to be 15 or 16 months in advance to the minute. Like, you know, next March 26th at 8:05, I'm going to be standing on the side of the stage at the House of Blues in Chicago waiting to, you know, that kind of literally down to that minutia. And so having like a winter, like it's in front of me, with nothing written on it is terrifying, you know. And I've kind of learned, I think, or at least used to be completely terrifying. And I think over the last 7 or 8 months, it's become less of a scary thing, and I see it more now like an opportunity, you know, like a, I see it more now like a thing that that bit of time might bring something cool, you know, and that's all right too, and so we'll see what happens.
Has it made you more independent? Because the first thing you said is you hoped that someone would tell you what the next thing would be, and that your life has been defined by someone else planning these calendar events for you. You know, do you find that this was a moment of where you realized that you could, you know, make these independent thoughts and plan your own path, so to speak?
Not really. No, I mean, my life remains extremely collaborative, you know. Like, I've always told people that, you know, it only says Alan Doyle on the poster or on the front of the book. There's a whole team of people that help me do all this stuff all the time, you know. And I've been real lucky to have, you know, a great manager and a great team and a great band and a great friends, and who, you know. And I'm totally happy to go to my agents, you know, in Canada, the U.S., or Europe, or whatever, and say, please find me fun work to do for this 5-week block. Thank you very much. And I'm totally happy to have Random House call me and say, Alan, will you write us a book in the month of May? And I'll like, yep, yeah, sure. Thank you. You know, like, so I'm not, you know, my life is way more kind of collaborative, I think, than people might imagine.
Is family support important in the performance field?
Oh yeah, in a bunch of ways. First of all, very practically speaking, you know, like, you know, if you want to have children and a house and a family, you need somebody in that house to look after your house and family when you're gone. That's just a very practical thing. So if you're lucky like me to have a great wife and a great kid, and we're surrounded by neighbors who know that when I'm on the road, maybe someone might need help putting the garbage out or shoveling a driveway or something. And then, you know, that's just very practical things, you know. And like, and my wife is awesome, and my friends are awesome, but there's also like a kind of an emotional thing where, you know, being in the arts for a living is really, really unpredictable, right? And it's very, you know, it's a bit of a dice roll all the time. And, you know, if you know, you need to have a group of people around you that are totally content to let you roll the dice all the time and hope for the best, and never knowing if it's going to work or not, and or if it's going to make any money or not. And so, you know, yeah, it's extremely important. And I don't know anyone who has a better network like that than me.
Is it hard to find that? I mean, you hear so often about marriages or relationships that don't last in that kind of a lifestyle. It takes a lot of commitment on both sides, I would imagine.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I've been lucky, like I say, I never had any doubts about where I wanted to live or, you know, what kind of life I wanted to have. I'm having it. And, you know, so you know, there are practical issues. Like I say, you're gone a lot, you know, so there's no way to be in the performative arts and live in Newfoundland and Labrador without being gone a lot. There's just no way to do it. And so, you know, it has challenges, but there's never been a doubt in my mind about, you know, where I want to be.
The title of this particular book is kind of telling in many ways. Altogether now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. Not a musician's, not a performer's, you know, not a guy from Petty Harbors, but a Newfoundlander's. Why was that so important in that title, do you think?
Well, to be honest with you, what I try to imply with that whole thing is that we come from a place that gives us a unique lens, right? And if you're from Petty Harbor, like I'm from, and the first plane ride you ever go on is to Trafalgar Square. That looks differently to somebody from Petty Harbor than it does to somebody from Manchester, right? And so, and all the stories in the book are told from the perspective of somebody who constantly found himself in circumstances that were unexpected and unusual, right? And you're in unusual company, you're in an unusual circumstance. And I think it was important for me to, you know, to let people know that the stories that I'm telling are through the lens of somebody who's not from most of the places that that are mentioned in the book, for example, that almost everywhere is a journey. When you in, you know, when you live on a rock in the middle of the ocean, you know, you almost got to go somewhere else to do almost anything in the performative arts, you know, so you're constantly seeing things through a lens that isn't local to the place that you're in.
And further to that, I think we all like to think we're rather unique here in Newfoundland and Labrador. You've had that opportunity. You've had that chance to visit, you know, all over North America, Europe, many other places besides, I'm sure. Are we unique, or do we just like to think we are?
No, we're unique. Yeah, we're different. Yeah, and I've explained, like, in various levels that, you know, the uniqueness of Newfoundland, even to our friends in Canada, right? I always tell people from Toronto, for example, you couldn't blame someone from Toronto for thinking that the geography of the coast of Nova Scotia or Prince Edward Island must be similar to what it is in Newfoundland. They're both Atlantic Canadian places that have fishing stuff going on. They must be very similar. But of course, I don't know if you've ever been to, you know, a beach, a Cavendish beach in Prince Edward Island. Compare that to the hills in Petty Harbor. And, you know, that's just one thing. That's just a geography that is different, right? And then, you know, you combine it with the historical, you know, realities of how this place ended up being settled and combine that with the fact that for hundreds and hundreds of years, we were literally a port in the storm for every single sailing country on earth, you know, came. And so there's these crazy influences and it's I think the history of the place has led it to be a special brew of something that is different than anywhere else for really good reasons. And to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know the answers to all those historical questions or what led exactly to it becoming what it is. And the book I mentioned earlier about the travel and stuff that we were going to do when the pandemic shut it down was trying to answer those exact questions. It was like, you know, what is in, you know, if the Southern Shore is made up of parts of Southern Ireland and Southern England, what are they like? You know, what led us to become what we are, you know?
Well, I think of it in terms of the Newfoundland pony or the Newfoundland dog, for that matter. You see a Newfoundland dog in Florida, that's not a Newfoundland dog, if you know what I mean. It's the geography, really, and the environment that creates that creature. Newfoundland ponies taken off the island are no longer really Newfoundland ponies, if you know what I mean, even though they're genetically different. So is it the geography, too, that helps mold and create
sure.
who we are?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't spent anywhere near as much time as I would like, for example, on the coast of Labrador. I've only been there a few times. And the realities of that kind of living and how, you know, people, you know, work, you know, in concert with their environment is amazing, you know, and to me. And I can't wait to learn more about it. But the thing I think that also makes us unique here is we have a unique isolation pattern in coastal Newfoundland, especially, right, where people left, you know, say, for example, a fishing town in the southern part of Ireland in 1550 and made their way somewhere on the southern shore or on the south coast of Newfoundland, for example, and then remained isolated down there for another 200 years. And so all the dialect and accents and stuff that they started with over in the south coast of Ireland, they still have. Right, but of course, over in the south coast of Ireland, they became really connected to England and Dublin and all these other places. So their accents changed. So the accent that they have down there is actually what it was like over there 250 years ago. And it changed over there, but didn't over here. And then, you know, so we've, and most of the places like I'm talking about didn't have libraries or newspapers or, and so they recorded all their history in song and story. And so it makes for a magical brew, if you ask me.
Alan Doyle is my guest today on Target St. John's. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today is Alan Doyle. He's out with a new book, All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. And you touched on it earlier, Alan, but why was this particular book so important at this time?
I just thought it would be a great project for me to work on in the spring to kind of keep me busy and creative and laughing at some of the follies of my life. And I thought it would be a great thing for people to have going into the winter when it got published right now, for people to do the same, you know, they're just lighter stories for times that aren't light at all.
When will it be on store shelves or available for purchase?
That came out 2 days ago. So this is Thursday, right? Yeah, it came out on Tuesday. So yeah, it's already available wherever you buy books. You can get hard copies, and if you want digital books, e-books, or whatever, you can find it there. And then there's also an audio book on the audio book streaming site. So it's just about anywhere you want to buy a book or listen to a book or stream a book, you can get it there.
Have you got another book inside you there somewhere?
Well, yeah. I mean, I still got want to do that other idea, that other book about, you know, like you and I were just chatting about trying to figure out what the origins of Newfoundland and Labrador are. You know, what ingredients went into to make this perfect stew. I think that'd be a fun book to do, like a travel book, to figure out, you know, try to answer a few questions that we all have.
I see you're still wearing that iconic jean jacket. Is it harder to find these days? I need to ask, because I used to love wearing jean jackets.
I do too. I still have a couple that I used to wear when I was in like first year university and stuff, and I can't remember. Yeah, there's one on the cover, isn't it? That was one of my older ones too. Yeah, you know, when it's funny, I think we all want to wear the clothes we wore in grade 12.
Worky boots, jean jackets,
you know,
those lumber jackets. Yeah, I remember it all well. Giving away my age there now. So we're going to go out, I guess, with a song, and we're going to play It's Okay. Let's talk a little bit about this particular piece before we go into it.
Oh, from the Songs from Home record, that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's a song I wrote with a couple of friends, really, just about just to remind people that, you know, dark days will come to an end, and that there's going to be a light, and that there's it's okay to feel bad, and it's okay to know that it's going to come to an end, and that there will be a brighter day down the road. And it's a real message I think people will love to hear. And then when we were doing the Songs from Home compilation collaborative effort, we just wanted one song that we could all sing together, and we all agreed that this was the message we wanted to go out on. So you're about to hear myself and Rachel Cousins and the Once and the Anna Sisters and Fortunate Ones all singing together. And what a great gang to sing with.
And before we go there, I know you'd been taking a lot of your performances into the online realm. Is that still happening, or did that have to come to an end?
No. I mean, we've been doing a few things. We did a couple of live streams from Yellow Belly a little while ago, and there's still lots of live streaming going on. And I got a feeling that as the numbers stay high in the rest of the country, I suspect that the live, virtual music world is going to be here for a little while yet.
Have people been appreciating that offering, if you will?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I still get the feeling people are hungry for live entertainment, you know. And then when the green light goes on, people will run back to it. And you know, we just did four little socially distanced shows down at Yellow Belly, and they sold out in a minute and a half. So I think people are eager for it.
Was that any different from how you would normally, you know, conduct a live performance? What kind of measures did you have to take?
Oh, yeah, they followed all the protocols. It was like a set up like kind of like a restaurant, if you will, with bubbled tables separated and specific instructions for getting in and out and all that kind of stuff, and mask wearing when you're not in your bubble and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it's all good. Yeah, we all did literally did whatever the doctor ordered.
Alan, it's been a pleasure having this chat with you this afternoon. I do appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. I know that you've got a busy circuit now promoting the book, as you say, and the book is now available for purchase. All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times by Alan Doyle. There's a few humdingers in there. I strongly encourage you to pick up the book. Alan, once again, thanks so much, and we're going to take us out with a musical interlude. It's Okay by Alan Doyle, Rachel Cousins. Who else is involved?
Rachel Cousins, the Anna Sisters, Fortunate Ones, and the Ones.
Excellent. So here we go. It's Okay.
Somewhere there's a rainbow. Somewhere there's a hill. Somewhere there's a moment we can kill.
Where the weather's far behind us, and we'll dance the skies to blue. 'Cause in the end, that's all you can do. So let the highs and lows roll on the winds that blow. We'll take them as they come. Won't let a day go by, because we're afraid to find a shadow on the sun. There's no perfect path of gold, and there's a bump in every road along the way. It's okay. Somewhere there's a daybreak, somewhere there's a moon, someway they'll both shine upon us soon.
It's okay.